The Living Clean podcast is not affiliated with Narcotics Anonymous, nor do we speak on behalf of NA as a whole. We are simply members sharing our personal experiences and perspectives in recovery-based discussions. The opinions expressed here are our own and not those of Narcotics Anonymous as a fellowship. This is the Living Clean podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to the Living Clean podcast. We're back for another episode. Tonight we're featuring another personal story. Francis and I had the honor to be in the audience at the convention and hear Hannah share her story. And Francis immediately thought, we got to get her on the podcast. And I agreed. So that's what we're doing tonight. And we're glad to have Hannah with us. But first, we're going to start with our introductions. I'm Mason. I'm an addict. Clean date 12118. Dark Side of the Moon is my home group. I'll kick it over to the co-host now.
I'm Francis. I'm an addict. Clean date is December 22nd, 1992. My home group is You Are the Book Book Study. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 6:30 a.m. in Chico, California.
I've always wanted to be your clean date, Francis. I appreciate that. Okay, and our very special guest tonight, Hannah.
Hey, guys. I'm Hannah O. My clean date is January 3rd, 2007, and my home group is the Mountaintop Group of Narcotics Anonymous in Decatur, Georgia, which is just outside of Atlanta.
Wonderful. Hotlanta.
It's something.
What's the recovery scene like in Atlanta?
You know, I got clean in Philly. So even though I've been here for over 15 years, you know, like it's, you always compare it to where you got clean. So it's different. And it still feels different all this time later, but there's a good mix of people, from, you know, NA really started here in the late 70s, early 80s. So, you know, you have people that are 35, 40 years clean. And then we have a lot of newcomers too. So it's a good mix, a good variety of people just trying to stay clean.
I'm not going to be able to remember the group name, but I went to a phenomenal meeting in Atlanta. I took a bunch of newcomers, like 15 of us. We all went to a Braves game and we stopped at a meeting. It would have been one of the noon meetings. It was off the chain. I loved it. The energy was good. The message was great. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
It's a good group of people.
Philly and Atlanta are like steeped in Narcotics Anonymous history.
Yeah. They are.
Yeah. Okay. So I think what we're going to do, Hannah, if you don't mind, we just turn it over to you and kind of walk us through your story. And unlike at a convention, Francis and I may jump in at some point and ask a question, but if you're on a roll, don't worry. Don't have any anxiety about us jumping in. We'll all let right. You go.
I'm here for it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was born in Texas, and this is important part of my story, because I was born, the youngest kid of three. I have two older brothers. And my father is a ultra conservative Southern Baptist pastor. So I was a preacher's kid, in a conservative family in the South my whole life. And, you know, from the time I was a kid, I got a lot of different messages, right? One was like, there's only one way to heaven and you have to try your best to be perfect. And this is the way you must live or you will die and go to hell. And so that was a message ingrained in me from the time I was young. And, you know, when I was young, my dad used to tell my brothers that they could be pastors and I could be a missionary. And I talk about this a lot because if you're not from a church environment, you don't understand the finer nuances of what that messaging meant. And what that meant was that my brothers, because they happen to have a penis, could be leaders and pastors in the pulpit. And because I had the audacity of having a vagina, then I could be a teacher. And that was it. And not only a teacher, right? There's even more finer nuances where really what my dad meant was like, I could be a foreign missionary, which means not only am I a teacher, I'm a teacher of people that don't speak English. I could be a teacher of people that were not American. I could be a teacher of people who are not white. And those were realities that were ingrained in me from a very young age. And, you know, as we got older, I realized that the reality of my family was that we had to look perfect. We weren't perfect, but we had to look perfect. And so it was ingrained in me too, that like you had to look good on the outside, but the inside didn't matter so much. So my dad would preach fire and brimstone on Sundays and then scream at my mother behind closed doors. He had like a raging porn addiction. And I know that because my brothers discovered it at a very young age, and my oldest brother began abusing me from the time I can remember, about age 3 or 4, until I was almost 12. And it was this world in which I had to have this facade, this fakeness about me in order to survive. And you know, it's interesting to me because while my brothers were told they could be pastors and I could be a missionary, later in life, I became the only one who would ever step foot in a pulpit. I'm getting ahead of myself. That is all because of Narcotics Anonymous. So let me get to some other things. At the age of 17, my oldest brother was murdered. He was also my abuser, but was murdered as a direct result of his disease. 6 months later, my other brother was diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer. And while we were going through the murder trials of my brother, they found the guys pretty quickly who did it. I discovered alcohol for the first time. And you know, it was my first drug of choice. I wound up in the other fellowship pretty quickly, like within 6 months of picking up. And there are a lot of people who, when they pick up, it takes them a lot of time to become an addict. It's a slow downward spiral. But for me, I was fucked from the first drink. I discovered something that meant that I didn't have to feel anymore. And you know, I was going through my brother's cancer treatments and the murder trials, and then my dad's church fired him. And that was my only place where I felt spiritually safe. And they abandoned me too. And so, I was a late bloomer at 18. Before that, I was voted most likely to become a nun in high school. That shit did not work out. I was nicknamed Holy Hannah. I led Bible studies before high school. I was trying to be everything I could be to gain my parents' affection, and it never really panned out. And then when I picked up at 18, it was fast and it was furious. And, you know, I got sober for 90 days in the other fellowship. And then I decided, like, I got this. I'm good. I'm just using because of my trauma, so I won't do that anymore. And, you know, I picked up right where I left off. And the boyfriend I had at the time when I tried getting sober and then failed kept me pretty buoyant for a while, like kept me stable. And then when that relationship ended, everything really fell apart. At the age of 21, you know, like I was already dabbling in other drugs, and it set off a shitstorm. And then I met a man. And as it goes with my story, meeting men, specific types of men, have always been trajectories, either really, really negative or really positive. And there's nowhere in between for me. I'm a woman of extremes. And this one was, in fact, quite negative. He made a lot of money in the tech industry. He seemed really fancy. He was British, so he had a nice little accent. And within a few short months of meeting him, I had actually married him, which, you know, I met him at my drug dealer's house. I don't know if you guys know this, but you should not marry people you meet at your drug dealer's house. It's not a good idea. But he would get us very high. He had a lot of money, and he would get me very high, and then would systematically and consistently sexually assault me as I was overdosing or coming back from an overdose over and over and over again. And despite that reality, in the midst of that relationship, had convinced me that I was the one that was out of control, and I was the one who was using too much, and I was the one that was going to fuck us all up and get us to a point where we couldn't live anymore. And during that time, I was looking for anyone to save me, right? When I was a kid, I looked for people to save me by having meltdowns at school, and no one ever noticed. And when I was in high school, I was looking for someone to save me from all the insanity of my brother dying, and no one would listen. And then in that situation, I was looking for someone to save me by cheating on him and looking for some prince to come in and ride on a white horse, pick me up. It didn't matter that what I didn't know then was, like, if there is a knight in shining armor, he's probably as sick as I am. I didn't know that, but I wanted it all the same, and no one ever came. And so he had found out I had cheated on him one more time and kicked me out of the house, turned off my cell phone. He had moved us out to California at the time. I was living in the South Bay area. And he had done that to separate me from all my friends and family and control me more. And I walked to the house, and I realized that if I went back, I was going to die. And I didn't think he was going to be the one to kill me. You know, that hadn't crossed my mind for some unknown reason. Trauma is a fickle fuck, man. But I did know the drugs were going to kill me. I did know they were going to kill me. And so I walked down to downtown Mountain View, California, and I called my parents from a payphone. And my parents love to be the hero of a story. So if I give them an opportunity to save me, they sure as fuck will. And they came out and got me and put me in rehab. And I never saw them again. I never went back. And that's really where my recovery journey began. That was January 3rd of 2007. It's the only full rehab and treatment I'd ever been a part of. It was my one and only, and I've stayed clean ever since. I had a couple hospital stays before that, a couple 3-day holds, you know how we do. But that was the only time I had been in a long-term treatment facility. And when I got out, I had a choice between moving in with my parents, and I didn't want to, my dad had a new church at the time, and I didn't want to be the poor pastor's kid just out of rehab, or I could move in with my brother. My brother, who had had that rare form of brain cancer, had survived against all odds. And he offered me a place to stay in my time of disaster, really. And so David gave me a place to stay. So I flew out to Philly, and it was like February of 2007. And I got off the plane, and he looked at me, and it was fucking cold. It was so cold. I'd never lived up north before. And Philadelphia in February is cold. It was so cold. And he looked at me and he said, "If you get high in my house, I will put you on the street. And I don't care if it's 20 degrees. And I said, "Okay." And he put me in the car and he drove me home. I asked him on the way to his house if he was scared. And he said, "No, I'm not scared." That's not right. He said he was scared. He said he was petrified, actually. He was so scared. He was scared I was going to get high again. He was scared I was going to go back to my ex. He was scared. I found out all that later, but he was scared. He got me home, and that night was too late to get to a meeting. And the next night, I went to the Friday night through Principals We Unite meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, which is in Sellersville, which is about an hour north of Philly. And at that meeting, I met people who would stand the tests of time in recovery. I ran into a bunch of the women that were at that first meeting at the World Convention recently. I met my sponsor, my first sponsor in NA there that night. I asked her that night to be my sponsor. I didn't know who the hell she was. I just know that the addiction counselor in rehab was like, get a sponsor. And if you don't like them, you can get a different one. And I knew how to get rid of people because I've been breaking up and cheating on people my whole life. So doing it with a sponsor was no big deal as far as I was concerned. So I got the first lady that I could find that was calm and patient and kind, because that was the opposite of what my parents were. And that seemed like a good place to start. And Jill T became my sponsor. And she was incredible. She's still one of my dearest friends. We speak regularly. And she walked me through the first couple of steps. And do those first few months, I didn't get a chance to talk about this at the convention. Those first few months clean were brutal. Because when you're coming out of a traumatic experience like that, like a consistent assaults and a childhood full of trauma, the PTSD and the mental instability I had when I first got clean was unreal. I had night terrors every night. I had panic attacks consistently, off and on every day. I was trying my damnedest just to get another day clean. And Jill was there, man. She was picking up the phone every other day. I had a network. I didn't drive. I had no way to meetings on my own. And so I got phone list after phone list after phone list. And every morning when I'd wake up, I would start calling people on that phone list. And by about noon, I would have a ride to my meeting that night. I did 89 meetings in 90 days. I missed one because someone forgot to pick me up. It was not my fault. I thought I had a ride. But like, you can do a 90 and 90 not driving. I had no car. I lost my license for 5 years. I had several DUIs and a driving on a suspended license. And, you know, the states of North Carolina and Georgia don't like that. Do not recommend. And so like, I started meeting people and learning what these people were about because I didn't have a car. It was a blessing that I didn't know I needed, because I was forced to make phone calls and get rides. And even if my brother could take me most of the time, I needed a ride home. So like, I always had to have these people in my pocket that would help me and support me and show up for me. And it was the first time I learned how to truly build a network of people. But it didn't take long for me to start doing that and start working the steps. And I got a first step. Powerlessness was real hard. It was real hard because I did not like the idea of being powerless after feeling so powerless in my addiction, at the expense or at the hands of other people. It was not something I wanted to feel again. And something Jill told me early on was that powerlessness does not mean helplessness. Powerlessness is just an acceptance of reality, that I was powerless whether I wanted to accept it or not. It just depended on how much pain I wanted in my life from a lack of acceptance. And so we worked the first step together. I dove into the step working guides for the first time, and I thought it was redundant and stupid, and I didn't like it. And she told me, get over it and do it anyway. And I did. I am a rebel in every sense of the word. And for a long time, a rebel without a cause. I get one later. We'll get to that. But like, I rebelled every step of the way. It took me an incredibly long time to get through the steps the first time. It took me about a year a step for a long time. Step a year. Like that was as good as it was really getting for a while. But I got through that first step and I worked it in the step working guide and had this level of acceptance that I had never experienced before in my life. And that allowed me to realize what I was and was not helpless over. And that was incredibly empowering, actually, to finally realize that I had a part of me that was no longer helpless and was capable of helping myself for the first time. About 6 months clean, I moved out on my own. I didn't know if I could stay clean without being on my own. But my brother was going through marital problems and I needed to go. And so I got an apartment. I paid someone to drive me to work, to and from work. I was poor. I was so fucking poor clean. It's the poorest I've ever been in my whole life. I ran out of, in Philadelphia, right? They run on fuel oil for heat, which is not anything I'd ever experienced in the South. And I did not know how expensive it was. So I made a mistake running my heat too early. Because remember, I'm from the South and that shit is cold. And so I ran my heat far more than I should have. And I ran out of fuel oil in the middle of the winter. And I had no money to get it replaced. And so my apartment sat at 45 degrees the whole rest of winter. And I did that shit clean. Like, I had to, it was my only option. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit cards. I was routinely getting boxes of food from the local church because I couldn't afford food half the time. But I kept showing up and I kept calling people for rides and I started working a second step and I started realizing that power greater than myself, which I resisted at first because the idea of God at this point in recovery, a God that I felt like abandoned me from my church, that my father couldn't stand the idea of me being ever in any kind of leadership, like that God could not exist to me. I don't fucking like God. I didn't want God. And then Jill looked at me, this very devout, very calm Christian woman who's in recovery. And she said, Hannah, the second step thing to do with God, if you don't want it to. And she was right. She was right. Because a power greater than myself on any given day were the people in my home group who taught me how to show up and open the meeting and make coffee. A power greater than myself was a newcomer walking in the door that needed a hug. A power greater than myself was people buying me food after the meeting because I couldn't afford to go out to eat and keep my lights on. A power greater than myself was anything but God. And that's what I needed in my life at that point. And it allowed me to heal long enough to start finding that God could look different than the God of my childhood. I didn't want a God that would send people to hell. I didn't want a God that didn't like these people that were saving my life. And these people that were saving my life were like Tina E., who has since passed. It was like this gay woman who looked like she was straight out of the 80s, who drove like a red 90s Camaro and would routinely like blast music while picking me up, going, "We're going to be clean." Like those people were saving my life and loving me better than anyone else had loved me in my whole life. And if my parents had met them, they would have thought they were going to hell. That was not the God that I wanted. And so as I started working a third step, for the first time, a God of my own understanding began evolving in a way that was beautiful and kind and calm. And it took many years for me to realize that the first time I really developed a God of my understanding, that God of my understanding looked very much like my first sponsor, Jill T, who is kind and calm and consistent and love my crazy. And at that point I had moved on to a new sponsor, right? Like I'm good at breaking up with people. I'm good at cheating. And so it took a while for me to get better at that. I'm not like that anymore. But I had gotten a new sponsor who had a little more time clean and had time for me. And Jill remained a friend. She taught me what true sponsorship could look like because I was so nervous. Was so nervous to break up with her, even though I was pretty good at it. I liked her. I didn't want her to be mad at me. And she told me that any sponsor who would get mad at me for moving on to something else that I needed was someone who needed to work on themselves and had nothing to do with me. And so I began working a third step with another woman and really starting to delve into what God could and would look like for me. And I started going to church just to see. I got into arguments with pastors. That was super fun. Listen, when you're raised like I am, you know scripture better than a lot of the pastors do. And I did. And I was an asshole. And I'm okay with it because they were assholes too. But I went with Jill a lot. Me and her were still really close, and I went to this event, this amazing event where it's like a woman's tea, right? Like they were all getting together to have like tea, and this woman missionary, foreign missionary, came and spoke. Remember, because women in the church, in these specific churches I was attending, could not be pastors, but they could be foreign missionaries, and this was one. She had been a missionary in Myanmar. And I'm sitting there, and I'm always raised with listening to that still, quiet voice, like the Holy Spirit or whatever. And I didn't believe in any of that shit at the time, but I knew better than to ignore whatever was resonating in my soul. And I lean over to Jill as this woman is speaking about Myanmar, and I was like, Jill. And she like looks over at me and she goes, "What?" I'm like, "God wants me to go to Myanmar." And her eyes got really big and she looked at me and in her infinite loving wisdom said, "Bitch, you are out of your mind. You are crazy." And she wasn't wrong, right? She wasn't wrong. But that started a series of events where I started researching how to get to Myanmar. And the only way to get to Myanmar was to be a doctor or a nurse because it was controlled by an entire military junta at the time. Like, you don't want to go there, it's dangerous. But I could get into Thailand. But the only way I could get to Thailand that I could find was through the Peace Corps. And that appealed to me because the Peace Corps had nothing to do with God. And that was awesome. I could go serve people and not have to like Jesus. Sounded like a great idea to me. The only way I could get into the Peace Corps, though, was to have a degree. And I had dropped out of college at 19. So then I started applying to colleges. And this all happened, by the way, guys, in like a month. Like it was not a long time. I made a decision I was going to go. And I got into two different colleges, one of which offered me a pretty large scholarship because they thought my story was fascinating. At this point, I had a year and a half clean. I'd started working a four step, and I was like, yeah, let's go to school. This sounds great. They accepted me in, and I moved on campus. And the reason why I actually chose this school was for two reasons. One, they had given me a pretty good scholarship. Two, there were meetings on campus, so I could walk there. Now it was about an hour from where I've previously been living, and so I didn't really know anyone in that area. I didn't have a network, and I still didn't have a car, and I still didn't have a license. So I moved on campus, so that I could walk to meetings if I needed to. Turns out I wouldn't have to walk that often, because people would pick my ass up on the way into the meeting. But I moved on campus, and I moved on campus with the understanding it would take me 3 years to get a degree. And at that point, after getting a degree, I could apply to the Peace Corps. And so maybe 3.5 years out, I might make it to Thailand. That was the goal. And I was on campus for about 15 minutes, and I met this woman named Esther, and she asked me why I decided to go to school. And she was in my dorm. And I told her that I wanted to go into the Peace Corps and go to Thailand. And she's like, oh, my boyfriend Anders was in the Peace Corps. He's actually taking a service trip to Thailand this summer. Like, do you want to go? And I was like, what? And within 30 minutes, she had him over. He talked to me and we had a plan that I could raise the money and get to Thailand. And so what I thought was going to be a 3.5 year journey took 3.5 months, 3.5 months of planning. And that is the first time I realized that a God of my understanding had nothing to do with my childhood God, but everything to do with living in the will of this calm, quiet inner voice that sometimes reminds me of Jill T. It is like that still quiet voice that is calm and consistent. It rarely plays with my emotions. It is never, it's almost always logical, which is important because I'm a highly emotional being. That is the balance of this goodness and truth. It's the balance between those two things. And that's important for me, because if it's all compassion and that's all it is, compassion without truth is just codependent. And I'd had enough of that to last a lifetime. And truth without that compassion is just cruel. And I'd had enough of that to last a lifetime too. And so my higher power at that time, that first third step for me, was the balance between those two things. And working on a fourth step, man, my first fourth step was brutal. And that is in part because of my PTSD and my trauma. And if you don't work a fourth step I needed outside help to get through it, because as I was working it, the night terrors, which had finally subsided, had started coming back working it. The panic attacks that had finally subsided were coming back, and I needed outside help in order to process those things in a way that was healthy. That's not true for everyone. Some people can just work it. That's well and good. I ain't that bitch. I needed a lot of help to get through a fourth step. It took me almost 2 years to do it. I had to piece it out in small sections a little at a time in order for my emotional and mental health to be in a good spot. But when I got to the end of it and I worked a fifth step, that was the point in which I decided, with my therapist and my sponsor at the time, to tell my parents about my abuse. And when I did that and I claimed that, because I was no longer helpless over what had happened to me as a child, it was over the phone. My therapist and my sponsor were in the room. And my father was pretty adamant that that wasn't really what happened. And my mom's response was, well, I always assumed something was going on, but I asked you once when you were seven and you denied it. So what was I supposed to do? And it was that reality that people had not shown up for me in my life. No one had ever shown up for me in my life as a kid or as a young adult. And it wasn't until I got in recovery and I had these incredible women in my life who would show up for me. I mean, these bitches moved me from Quakertown all the way down to Northeast Philadelphia. They packed up my stuff to move me to college. They thought I was crazy. And they were like, okay, you want to go to Thailand, but to go to Thailand, you got to go to college. Okay. Like, they just had my back in a way. They would pick up the phone when I was having panic attacks on my fourth step. These people had shown up for me in ways that my parents never could. And as I was learning more about God, and I was doing that, not only from working a third step, but also because my degree happened to be in religion, with the emphasis on ancient language. So I was learning Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, I could read a little Latin. I really wanted to be able to just like bitch slap my dad with facts. That felt a rebel. Remember, I loved being a rebel. And being able to do it better than he could was one of the only ways I could survive going home and visiting them. And so I started working. I did that fourth and fifth step. I told my parents what was going on. I was learning this like theology, like, that I had never fully comprehended before. And I was finally coming into my own. Like, I was able to stand on my own two feet when my dad had shit theology. I was able to stand on my own two feet when I didn't agree with what my school was doing. I led protest movements pretty early on in recovery. I mean, I almost got kicked out of school in undergrad. I've almost gotten kicked out of every school I've been in clean, but it started in undergrad for the LGBTQIA community. And I gave no fucks, and I almost got kicked out by leading a protest, or trying to. We had a whole plan, and someone ratted us out, and I wouldn't back down. And so they changed policy and would back up LGBTQIA plus people. That school too did not believe in women being in the clergy. And I started a movement to have a chapel led by the students and became the first woman in its entire history to stand at the podium and give a sermon. I went to Thailand not once, but twice and three times, and was really able to learn how to support myself in a way that no one had done for me as a kid. And the only way I could do that was because of the people in Narcotics Anonymous, man. Like, they taught me how to show up. And so then I was able to show up for myself really for the first time. And it's crazy, right? Because in that area of Philadelphia, there is a large Jewish population. And I didn't like going home. So around Christmas, a lot of the times, I would be the only one in the dorms. And I would go to meetings on Christmas because there's nothing else to do. And I would be in this room, and you know who goes to meetings at Christmas in Northeast Philadelphia? A lot of Jewish people. So it would be me and a lot of the Jewish folks in recovery. And it was the running joke that I was the only one there who could read Hebrew really well. And then we'd all go out for Chinese food. So, you know, I learned how to be in community and understanding what diversity really looked like from a religious perspective, and how these different people from all of these different faith backgrounds would come together for a sole purpose of staying clean. And it changed my life. It changed how I perceived God and how I perceived religion and how I wanted to live my life going forward. I started working a sixth step with my new sponsor. Now, at this point, I've had like four or five guys. I haven't talked about all of them because, again, I'm really good at breaking up with people at this point. And Stacy was my sponsor. And God, I love Stacy. She was also very calm and quiet, very like mellow, like very stable. And again, that's important to me because at this point, I just finished a fifth step and I'm working on my sixth step and my defects of character. If you ever go, if you're in the throes of like PTSD stuff and you're going through a fourth and fifth step and then straight into your defects of character, that is a wild ride. It is like, it can be done. It is possible. I am proof that it's possible, but it's tough. It's tough. And Stacy was just steady as a rock, man, very calm. And walked me through a sixth step, focusing on my defects, realizing, you know, what could be changed, what needed to be changed. And it was the first time I realized that my defects of character were just assets on steroids that had gone too far, and that my rebellion was important because it meant that I could pick up the cause of people around me, and that my brashness, I'll just say it like I think it should be, and I don't give a fuck what anyone thinks, is all well and good as long as I'm willing to be compassionate with how I say it. She just showed me how every defect had a corresponding asset. It was like two sides of the same coin. And as I was going through that process with her, I had the opportunity to either go to grad school, I was finishing up school at this time, or I could go back to Thailand permanently. And I had gotten into a really prestigious grad school. I had gotten a really good scholarship. Turns out when I'm not doing loads of dope, I'm really smart. Did not realize that until I started learning like three ancient languages at the same time. Apparently normal people can't do that. Didn't realize it. Yeah, man, I got into a really prestigious grad school, or I could give all that up, sell all my shit, and move to Thailand. And I called up Stacy, and I was like, Stacy, I'm going to go to Thailand. And Stacy, calm, cool, collected, was just like, bitch, you are crazy. And she believed it. She thought I was insane. But within 6 months, I sold everything. I finally got my license and a car. Like, I had gotten that 6 months ago. And then I sold it to move to Thailand. And I moved there with the full intent of never coming back. And I didn't tell anyone that except for Jill. And I told Jill that as I was moving my stuff into her, I moved it into her house. I had two big plastic bins and they went into her attic. And I told her that I didn't know if I was ever going to get it back because I didn't know if I was going to come back. I was going to build a life for myself in Thailand. There's still work for me to do there. And I did. I flew to Thailand. Stacy was still my sponsor. Doing that remote on a 12-hour time difference was wild, but it's doable. Long-distance sponsorship is real in a technological world, man. And there wasn't a lot of women with tons of clean time in Thailand. So it was important for me to have that connection back home. I was working an 8-step while working at a non-governmental organization, like a foreign nonprofit, and quickly realized that they had not translated literature into Thai yet. And so every weekend, I was out in the countryside. I was like one of four Americans in like a 100-mile radius. So I was like only person, there was only like three people that spoke English. And so on the weekends, I would go down into Chiang Mai and hang out in Chiang Mai. And would sit with these couple of guys who are trying to figure out how to translate literature into Thai. And I didn't know Thai, but I did understand translation. And I learned that in my undergrad. When you're translating a foreign language, especially one that is ancient, it is a lesson in accepting failure because you are never going to get it right. And so I would sit there after the meeting, smoking really cheap Thai cigarettes, talking about all the different ways we could translate one word in English into Thai. And the root of that, the foundation of that would become some of the first Thai literature. And I'm not gonna like say like I was the reason why NA literature is in Thai. I wasn't. I didn't play that big of a role. But I did play a role in showing how translation could be done and how words have all these different layers of meaning and what that could look like. And that was experience I got in my undergrad that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And, you know, I was in Thailand for about 3 months. And when you have 3 months on a visa, on a foreign visa, you usually have to cross over a national territory, a national line, and get your visa restamped. And the closest, there were two closest borders, one was Vietnam and one was Myanmar. And for a long time, that border wasn't open to Americans, but the military junta had been overthrown and they had reopened the border. And, you know, as a joke, I told some of my volunteers, well, God told me to go to Myanmar once, so I'm going to go there. It was funny because they're all atheists and they thought I was fucking crazy. So I got on like this tourist bus to go to the Myanmar border and I crossed over into Myanmar. And it's so funny because my sponsees always ask me like, are you going to tell everyone how you took a shit in Myanmar? Well, yeah, I am. Because I crossed the border. I bought really cheap cigarettes in Myanmar. I bought some roasted chestnuts and I took a shit. And then I came back because any longer than that, and it does become pretty dangerous. And so I crossed the border and had my passport stamped and headed back to the nonprofit I was working for. And within 24 hours of that, not even a full day, I got a phone call and my brother's cancer was back. And it was almost like I had this job to do. I had this mission to fulfill. And the moment I had fulfilled that plan that God had in my life, I was called back home because my parents like to be the hero, but that often means that when they're being the hero, they aren't making good decisions for the people around them. And so I was my brother's medical power of attorney. I was the one that he trusted most. He had helped me in a time of my own crisis, and now it was time to help him with his. And I flew home from the time I got that call to the time I was in Atlanta, Georgia, was 18 hours, which is a feat I don't think anyone should do. It is a lot of flights very quickly and with no time to like figure out like what your brain is doing. And I landed and And I went to show up for my brother. He had brain surgery that morning, and I landed not knowing how it had gone. I had no American cell phone. I asked the lady on the tarmac if I could use her cell phone to call my parents to let them know I had landed. Someone was picking me up at the airport. And like what happened over the next few months was nothing short of heartbreaking. You know, like I landed, I took care of my brother. And by January 3rd, I landed on October 3rd. And by January 3rd, he had passed away from his brain cancer. He passed away on my anniversary, like the asshole he was, always stealing my thunder. And he died on my 5-year clean date. In the time that I've been home, I met a guy, because that's my MO, that's what I do. I met a man, and me and him hit it off pretty quick. He is also in recovery. And, you know, I think we had dated for a couple weeks when he moved me in, because I had really nowhere else to go. It was like my parents' house or his house. And he's like, well, I guess I better move you in then. And he did. And we stayed together for quite a while. We ended up having a son together, and I kept the kid, got rid of the man. He's still clean, but it was necessary for my life. And yeah, it was a wild time, man. Like, I had met this man, we were hitting it off, and my brother died. And on the day he died, there was only, I don't want to be clean. I want to be very clean, clear that I did not want to be clean. And that was the first time I realized that you don't need to want to be clean to stay clean. I did not want to be clean. I did not want to feel. I wanted to get high. And I made the decision to stay clean anyway. And that was because in the 3 months I had been back, I was sponsoring a handful of women, because there was not a ton of women with clean time in Northeast Georgia at that time. There were some, but not a lot. And every single one of those women that I sponsored had had a sponsor who had gotten high. And I refused to be one of those bitches. I wasn't going to get high on those women. And the other was because that man that I had met would have almost certainly left me if I had gotten high. And I am nothing but codependent. I have not worked on that yet. And I was like, I don't want him to leave me. I guess I better not smoke crack. And those, I didn't stay clean out of some honest desire. I stayed clean because I had a desire. I didn't want to, but I had a desire. And that was enough. I stayed clean. And like I said, there weren't a lot of women who were clean in Northeast Georgia. Stacy had been sponsoring me all that time, but I really needed something closer to home. It was the first time I ever got a male sponsor. I'm not going to say that it's, I suggest it, but I will say that it worked for me. Tom was an incredible sponsor and showed up for me in a way that others in that area could not. And Tom was very much like all the other sponsors I had had. He was calm, and he was kind, and he was consistent, and in many ways resembled my higher power. And it's funny, because Tom is a Black man. And so for the first time in my life, I really had this connection to God that reminded me of a Black man. And it was lovely. It was the thing I needed to like fully heal that relationship with God. He walked me through an eighth and ninth step. He walked me through a 10th and 11th step. Like, that man ensured that I had consistency in a time of great despair. And should not be ever undervalued how people can show up just by being calm and consistent and kind. And I was with that man clean and stayed clean and needed a new project, man. I didn't have Thailand. I didn't have grad school yet. And so I started applying. I started applying to grad school and decided to get a master's of divinity, all while working my eighth and ninth step, like really making amends and doing all the things that I needed to do for myself and my recovery. I had a home group that whole time. had people in my life, was sponsoring people and had a sponsor and needed a new project. So I applied for grad school and got in. I got into grad school where I would get my master's of divinity. So that means I'm ordained clergy. I love Jesus, but I curse a lot, you know, like, and that's how I roll. I don't even particularly love Jesus. It's just a phrase I use, which is an interesting concept for someone who's ordained clergy. But I have this education that is focused on interfaith chaplaincy, which means that I am capable and trained in showing up for anyone of any religion or faith or lack of faith. And because of that, my own theology is very diverse. And I don't believe that someone needs to believe in a certain way to avoid hell. And I don't even believe that hell exists. We can get into that on a different day. But the whole point is that my education, my master's of divinity, allowed me a concept of faith that I could actually practice in an 11th step. Because there was no way that the faith of even the school I went to was going to work out. There was no way the faith of my childhood was going to work out. I didn't even fully know what I believed in God. What I did know is that there was one, and And getting that master's and being trained in how to support and spiritually show up for people regardless of their faith was incredibly important to my journey. And I did my chaplaincy training at the Veterans Administration, where I got to show up for veterans who, you know, being of service to people who they themselves have served is a blessing, and is incredibly radicalizing, because that is where I learned from the veterans themselves what it was like to be a Black veteran in Vietnam and come back to the South that was still highly segregated in a lot of ways. And they showed me what it was to face racism, both in the medical system and in the military. And it was where I learned how to show up for people whose trauma I could never fathom and who routinely showed up for me and mine. I'll never forget sitting in a recovery group that focused on PTSD at the VA. I was the moderator, right? Like, I'm the person there who's like helping them. And I said something like, I can never fully understand your trauma, but I have, this is my own. And I think it, you know, it relates. And one of those veterans just goes, interesting that you don't think your trauma is somehow as valid as ours. That's weird. And it was like just this moment where it was like this veteran who has literally seen warfare just heard a part of my story and validated my trauma in a way that my therapist hadn't even done for me, that my sponsors didn't know how to do for me. And that because I was able to show up for other people and learn a new way of faith and faith practice, I had the ability to be helped as well. And I love that about Narcotics Anonymous, right? I love that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. And I can't tell you how many times newcomers have helped me and how as a newcomer, I'm hopeful I helped others. I mean, I'm sure I was an asshole a lot of the time, but I think I helped a little, you know, nothing like a crazy chick in Northeast Philadelphia. But I was able to go through that process, and in that process, while also, you know, practicing this 11th step and looking at what a 12th step looked like for me, and being radicalized by my education, you know, a rebel with a cause, man. I started getting involved around that time was, 2020. And all that went with it. And that included protests and riots in the streets of Atlanta and across the country, and was able to take that rebellion and put it to good use, practicing that spiritual care with those who were protesting, providing them spiritual care so that their trauma could be reduced while they were protesting, and was really able to stand in the gap. Because I tell you what, there's nothing that Atlanta police like less than Black people rioting in the streets, than white women in clergy collars on the front page of papers and handcuffs. They don't like it, and so they wouldn't arrest the people I was standing in front of. I learned how to use my privilege in a very real way. And that's something, you know, we don't talk a ton about, but in NA, we talk all the time about how our diversity is our strength and how we have this equity because the newcomer is the most important person in the room. And we have this inclusivity because if we don't invite everyone in, then people will fucking die. And I learned the basics of how to treat humans in my community because of Narcotics Anonymous. And because of the 12 steps and that practice, I was able to show that to my community in a way that allowed people to be protected and their First Amendment rights to be protected. And when we protect those people's First Amendment rights, then ours are protected in NA as well. And it was just this full circle moment that I had the capability of doing that. And, you know, I did other things in grad school and through my 12 step too. I was able to have the honor of participating in victim offender mediation, which means that I sat down with one of the men that killed my oldest brother and had a 4-hour conversation with that man. And was out in Texas where he was murdered. And I believe it was a huge part of my faith practice and my pursuit of justice. This very simple idea that justice is the balance between, like, I can't even say it right. Justice is really this belief that when that man gets out of jail one day, he doesn't have to fear for his life and I won't have to fear for mine. That was justice. And the only way to find that was through victim offender mediation. And my husband at the time, because I had married that guy who I had the kid with, didn't really want to go. And we were in marriage counseling and our therapist looked at him and was like, dude, you have to go. He didn't want to. We had a 6-month-old at the time. And I asked my best friend in recovery to go with me as well, because he said he would go, but he wouldn't go into the prison with me. He didn't understand it. He didn't get it. And so Anna said she would go. And Anna is calm and she is kind and she is consistent. And so she was my higher power's presence in the room. And we flew out to Texas. And as I was entering that room to speak to this man who had, like, quite literally had my brother's blood on his hands at one point in his life, it was not my husband who was with me. It was my best friend. And I'll never forget that warden looked at me and he's like, no matter what, we've got your back. And Anna just goes, yeah. And in that moment, it was the first time in my whole life that people had my back, not only with my crazy ideas, but with full intent of knowing those crazy ideas were going to cause emotional turmoil, and supported me anyway. And when I got done with that visit and got back home, it was within a few months that I asked for a divorce because I don't want to be married to someone who doesn't have my back in that way. I don't ever want to have a family that doesn't have my back in that way ever again. And it was a very calm and kind divorce. I don't know if you guys know this, but you can get divorced with, like, compassion and kindness when you have 12 steps and 12 traditions in your life. And we did. We had no attorneys. We did it ourselves. We figured out custody and child support without any attorneys involved. We did it all ourselves. And it took a lot of trust and kindness, but it was probably one of the most compassionate and kind divorces I've ever been a part of. I've only been a part of two, and the other one was an asshole who raped me pretty consistently. So, you know, it's going to be better than that. But it was very kind and compassionate, and we are still good co-parents to this day, for which I am truly grateful. Yeah, man, the last few years have been wild since then. I got job in tech, lost jobs in tech. I got laid off, got jobs in nonprofit, got laid off in nonprofit. Now I'm working in nonprofit again. Like, life is wild and beautiful. And I was single for a long time after that divorce. Only a couple of boyfriends in between that weren't long lasting or kind. And finally found a partner in recovery who is clean and lovely. And he is kind and calm and compassionate and consistent. And has all the qualities I've always looked for in recovery. And he is that in my life. And together we have a blended family of four children, all of whom are neurospicy. We are a neurospicy, neurodivergent household of cornucopia of acronyms that are delightful. And now we're just living life at this point. And it's not a bad way to live, you know? Thanks for letting me share.
Wow. That was as good, if not better, than the first time. What do you think, Francis?
Yes, I'm looking up Nero Spicy as we speak.
Yeah, no, that was great. You know, it's funny how stories are very different, but in a lot of ways, you know, I could find ways to relate to you, especially with, you know, the situation with your siblings. You know, like I've, you know, experienced that over the last year. I've lost two siblings, and you know, one, I was at my wedding, and my sister was talking about having headaches, and you know, 3 months later she was gone, and that was a year ago. So it's tough, and yeah, but here we are, clean, made it through it.
So I wasn't really responsible for her getting here. She was responsible for herself getting here. She did listen to the podcast, and she listened to us sharing out about the convention, and she sent me a Facebook message thanking us or something to that nature for giving her a shout out. And I'm like, oh, well, let's get you onto the podcast then. So, I think that might have been divinely inspired. She says, I heard y'all talked about me on the podcast. Your belief in me and my message is humbling. And it went from there. So I don't know if that was her or if that was me or if that was divinity kind of coming through. So that's exciting. Yeah, I'm very fascinated with not only your background, but how you like walked through getting an education in divinity. I guess that's your like your rebelliousness and your radicalization to prove your dad wrong or something. But when I was new, there was like this shitstorm that was happening at the World Service Conference around gender inclusive language, kind of like what's happening now, but in relationship to God. And so I thought, I'm like, if she was around then, I wonder what she would think about that.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? And people will disagree with me, and I don't particularly care. But when I read any of the readings with the male pronouns for God, I change them because my God is not male. And so for me, it's really important that God, as I understand God, is more often than not a woman, not always, but pretty much 99% of the time. And so I either take out the male pronouns and it's God as I understand God or God as I understand her, depending on the day. And my perception of God must be that way because the male God of my childhood was domineering and cruel and unkind. And my God is kind and compassionate and consistent. And those are almost all qualities, for the most part, that I have found in women and women specifically who are in recovery. Now, I found that in women through my education, both professors and people I went to school with. But for the most part, like God is a woman. And, you know, people can be with me changing the pronouns when I read them if they want. And that's fine. They can disagree. I'm going to keep doing it.
I thought that it was interesting you were saying that you were sponsored by an African-American gentleman at one time. And I wonder if that kind of like helped you heal some of the trauma around men. Like there are maybe some safe guys out there that, you know, like that can be trusted, if that's a piece of your healing.
No, men are still scary. I don't like them. That said, that doesn't mean that the logical part of my brain doesn't realize that there are some who are safe. But when I walk into a room, whether it's at an NA convention or at a restaurant, my first thought is not like some of these men are probably okay. My first thought is I'm in danger every time, and that will never go away. And that is something that has eased some, but is still present. That doesn't mean that I can't develop a sense of safety with some men, and on occasion, deep and meaningful relationships with some men, both in my romantic relationships, like with my partner now, and with my sponsor at that time. But having one relationship with one man as a sponsor does not heal the wounds that have been there for a lifetime. And understanding trauma means that those relationships don't actually build trust with men. It builds relationships and heals wounds with single individuals. And that is really important for me as part of my story. I mean, there was a long time where going to a convention in NA, even though none of my trauma happened in NA, because I was surrounded by all of these people, the vast majority of the time, the vast majority of them being men, meant that I am, even at this last convention, in a state of great anxiety the entire time I'm there. I don't particularly like conventions. I go because my partner loves them. And I love him and I feel safe with him. So like, it's just that reality that that feeling of safety is something that isn't healed overnight or even with one individual man.
Well, I'm sure glad that you walked through that fear to come to that convention, because it was such a joy to have you there. I know that for sure.
Me too, man. Like, it's worth it. It's worth walking through fear, you know? It's like, and that's something else too. Like, fear is fear. I don't believe that fear is a lack of faith. Fear is really an indicator of what you have experienced. And walking through that fear and not believing that what you've experienced will happen again is really important part of defeating both the trauma and the PTSD. And also realizing, like, I don't put myself in the same kind of dangerous situations as I used to. All that. I mean, I think we all know that when we go to a convention, there are some very unsafe people there, right? Like, there are some people who only have a day or two clean. Like, these are not like people that are necessarily brimming with hope and good belief systems, but they can get there. And I know they can get there. And so it is worth being there because I can show them that it is possible.
Well, I can tell you for sure that there were dangerous people there. As being on the committee, I had to answer questions about a suspicious person and flattening the tires of somebody's car. I think that had to do with a love triangle.
Man, I haven't slashed tires in so long.
It happened at the convention. Somebody did at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was worried I set off an alarm for being a California liberal there or something. My wife has some safety issues that I try to stay conscious of all the time, and you know, like, she's always wants me to lock the door, and I just don't even think about it, and so like I have no issue walking down the street. But I know other people do, you know, like I don't have like the same type of safety stuff other people do. And like, it's sometimes I lose track of that. And it's kind of important for me to like hear, you know, like that we're that everybody has a different experience around safety. And that includes in coming into the rooms. So the first person I got through the 12 steps was a woman. And to be honest with you, my understanding is she didn't make the other women feel safe. And so she was kind of by default ended up with me. And it, what a great experience that was. But it was also me addressing my own safety issues and like being told I couldn't do this because you're a guy and you're not safe. And then me having to believe that God is bigger than all that stuff and treating it like a real sacred type of relationship, and valuing that above, you know, like all that other stuff, you know. So was a great gift that was given to me to be able to, the first person to take through the steps was somebody of the opposite gender. But you know, like in the end, what it taught me was that I, you know, like around, it was like the whole thing about anonymity and just trying to love everybody unconditionally where they're at. So, yeah.
You said something earlier that's kind of stuck out to me. That was, I think all of my character defects are assets. They're just driven to the extremes. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when we were talking about fear, that's another thing, right? Like fear in it at its core can be something that keeps us safe.
That's right.
You know, but when we take it to the extremes is when it becomes detrimental to us. But at its core, it is there for a reason. Anxiety is there for a reason.
Yeah, dude. You know, just finished another 6-step. And like one of my biggest ones is control, right? Like I'm a control freak. Like I think we all are. But like control and controlling as much as I could around me is the only reason why I'm alive right now. Like I have to give a lot of reverence to my, it's like they kept me alive. They kept me from going down or over the edge and into the abyss. But at the same time, like they are also destructive now in this new life that I have. And so it's like, what parts of control are like actually really beneficial to me? Like, what is the asset there? And like, because I'm a control freak, I can see this whole system in front of me a lot of the time, and I can see all the different aspects, and that makes me really good at my job. But it also means that if I try and control my romantic relationship, it's going to end me in a world of hurt. And so it's like seeing where it's truly useful and where it's destructive and figuring out where the asset becomes the defect and what, where is my willingness for the defect to be removed so the asset can actually shine.
Yeah. I love the step working guide's definition of a character defect, the basic human trait distorted by our own self-centeredness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is your 11th step practice?
So on any given day, my 11th step practice is really telling men to go fuck themselves. No, I'm kidding. not really. So the thing is like the world has told me no 1,000 times, right? Like my dad told me no. No, you can't do that. You're an addict. No, you can't do that. You're too newly clean. No, you can't do that. You don't have enough money. No, you can't do that. You're a woman again. No, you can't do that. You're too little. No, you can't. It's no, no, no. And my practice on a regular basis is say, fuck it. I'm going to do it anyway. And every time I hear that no, my answer becomes yes. And how can it be yes? And how can it be yes with ethics and morals? And how can it be yes while helping the community around me? And how can it be yes in these different areas of my life? And right now, my 11th step is really focused in my work. I work at a nonprofit law firm. We defend people that no one else will. We are one of the only holistic defense law firms in the state of Georgia. And I'm their operations director. I do all of their HR, finance, and technology. And on a consistent basis, I am the one who is supporting people who are doing incredibly emotionally difficult work. And I am trying to make their lives a little better while at the office, a little bit easier so they can do that difficult work. And right now, my practice is showing up for those people in a real way, as consistently as I possibly can. And it's hard and it's difficult. And also, my 11th step is very much focused on these four little lives I have in my household. Listen, guys, I don't particularly like children. I don't. And now I have four of them. And I do love them, though. And the difference between like and love is real. Like, I don't always like them, but I do love them a whole lot. And a lot of times I like them too. But there are these four little humans that have ADHD and autism and emotional trauma and like have all these things going on in their life. And I have the opportunity to show up and give snuggles and talk to them about their emotions and talk to them about how we think about God and how we don't and what that looks like. And my practice shows up in my work and with my children. That's where my practice is today.
Well, I think it's interesting. We just did a podcast on Atheists Recover Too, and in it, he talked about his life as a prayer. You know, like if he practices spiritual principles, you know, like his life can be a prayer. And so when you were talking about, you know, like the work that you do, like you showing up to your life and practicing the principles that you believe in can be that prayer. It could be, is that practice?
Wow.
Me shamelessly plugging the atheist.
I'm here for it.
Episode.
God bless the atheists.
God bless them. Well, I think we're just about, well, I'm just about out of time. I've got a business meeting to go to. Everybody's favorite thing. Woo, business meeting. Can't wait.
Practice some spiritual principles, Mason.
Get excited. I do. And that's part of, I guess, my life as a prayer right there, you know.
There you go.
I'm sending you my thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. But Hannah, thank you so much for coming on. Just keep being you and keep saying fuck it and not let people tell you that you can't do something. Or let them tell you and do it any fucking way.
They can tell me all they want. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. No, that was incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. It means a whole lot.
All right. We will be back next week with another episode. See y'all then.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, to stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.